First Kings chapter 2, and we're at the end of David's life. It's been a ride, huh? Been a ride. So, I don't know. It's been a good ride for you guys, Life of David. We've been doing the Life of David for 1 and 2 Samuel for a little while now, a few weeks. And it's been a good thing. Like I always say, it's kind of unfair. I always feel like I cheat. I get the most benefit from it because I study and spend the time doing it to try to teach, and I'm always blessed by that. So David's always been a hero of mine, somebody that I looked up to, and it was good for me. This ride through all my life, I've heard about David, since the little lies about 12-year-old going beating up on the giant in Sunday school. But it's been a sweet ride for me to go through it and dispel some of the things that are just hard to get rid of, about the enemy is so strong and young. Well, David was an adulterer, and see, he's fine with God, so we're okay. David was just a sinner, and God was okay with him, so I guess God'd be okay with me. And it's very, very easy to lose the true story that God gave us about the nature of David's heart. He was a man after God's heart. So, for us to ascribe to him that he was a rebellious sinner that God was fine with would be, I don't think a rebellious sinner would be the heart of God. So, did he sin? Yeah, he sinned. He sinned greatly. Like I said last week, If all of us had the secret sins of our life written openly in a book for everyone to read, and then we sit here by the grace of God hoping to have a relationship, knowing and longing to have a relationship with God for now and for eternity, it would be looked at much the same way, right? Or worse. Much the same way. So, here we are closing David's life. This is the last chapter. And then we're going to go somewhere else for a while on the where we study. So this is the last of his life. And there's some important things here. So let's trust God to lead us and teach us. Because that's the kind of dad you are, God. And I thank you that you are so far above that we don't have to worry about what mood you're in, or that you come today as the steady and faithful, the giver of unconditional love, the Father who pursues us fervently and even vehemently, the Father who is willing to allow his children to suffer because you love us that much. I thank you for giving us this life of David written down in a lot of information. And I feel like every week, I feel like I only touch it where we go in each chapter. And I feel like there's so much more in content. We could start over at the beginning and it'd be full and rich again. But here we are. I ask you to, in all of our hearts, to embed a couple things, God. One is a desire to look deeper into your word. So when we read over it and we struggle and we go, how does that make sense? Or why did you do that? Or God, why did you do that? Or why did that person do that? Or that we would realize we just need to understand. It's not that it's wrong and you don't act wrongly. That when we see the wrongness of men, we look at their hearts, and we look at your grace. There, we often, God, please, the other thing I ask is that you would change our perception. That we tend to think of the God of the New Testament as the God of grace, in quotations, and we think the God of Old Testament is not the God of grace, it's the God of wrath. But that's a lie. There's greater grace shown and more of it in the Old Testament even than the New, and as it should be. The when we can be born again and filled with your Spirit, that's a powerful thing, that our lives should look different than those who are not. So, God, please teach us and give us a sweet spot for David and his heart after you. Cause us to always long to have that description of us, about us, to have a heart after you. I don't think there's a better statement or a greater statement that could be made. So teach us, God, because we want to be taught or we wouldn't be here. Soften our hearts, pour into our hearts in ways that we don't even expect. And I thank you for making that way because of Jesus. Amen. 2 Kings chapter 2. As David's time drew near, he charged Solomon, his son, saying, I am going the way of all the earth. You know, last week I shared that David was probably, or Solomon was probably somewhere in the 20s to 30s, and setting it more this week, you know, I wouldn't necessarily consider, we don't know how old Solomon was, we don't ever really have an age on him. But there is a good chance, and who take a lot of time to try to look at the years and when potentially he's born. It doesn't really tell us when he was born after, you know, David and Bathsheba's first son died. Doesn't really tell us, but he was their second son doing it. And David was obviously reigning for 33 years there, but some would speculate that he was 16 years old or so. Pretty dim. So he was young. Somewhere between 16 and 30, I would say. I think that's an important precedence to kind of look at. You know, the age of 30 in the Bible is a pretty, pretty big deal. Seems like, you know, the age of 30, I mean, there's a lot of men of the Bible that really began a powerful ministry at that time. You know, it seems like there was a tremendous amount of prep from young birth to 30, and at 30, you know, whether it was John the Baptist, you know, whether it was Jesus, you know, they began their ministry at 30. It talks about Ezekiel. He began his ministry at 30 doing it. David began reigning as king at 30. You know, I don't think it's necessarily a magic number, but I would also contend that if you're 30 and you're not acting in maturity and functioning in the power and authority of God, get with it. If you're older than that, then, you know, I would say that 30 is kind of a breakover point in the Bible. And again, not that you shouldn't before. Obviously, David functioned powerfully in the power of God prior to 30, right? You know, we have a record of him as a young man, you know, functioning the power and authority of God, walking with God, because that's as it should be. You know, you don't perform at 30 in the fullness, in the power of God, and what he's called you to do in a mature and responsible way if you haven't prepared for that. And prepared for that means going through the process, training, working, being after it. So, you know, you look at, we're an incredibly pathetic culture. And I say this for you, largely for those of you who have kids and are involved in kids and stuff, is it's been said on Thursday nights, and I would tend to agree with it, that there's this perception, adolescence is something that is made up by our culture. That really isn't how it should be, even biblically. You should go from boyhood to manhood on doing it. Adolescence is something that is an excuse for not growing up in our culture. And when I say that 30 is a beginning of ministry, that doesn't mean you get to not be a man before that. My contention is you better start being a man much earlier. You know, our culture has said you don't have to become a man. You know, you can stay a boy, and that takes on various forms. You know, one of the strong ones in the Bible that the Bible is about and has not changed is only men get to have sex. Men who are responsible, men who are who are able to push, able to take care of a wife and a family, able to stand on their own and take responsibility for a wife and kids. In our culture, we say boys can have sex. You can be irresponsible and have sex. You can, you know, be a college boy. You can be a, you know, teenager. You can do whatever. In the Bible, it says that, you know, what's the requirements for getting married? You must be able to move out of your dad's home. That doesn't mean necessarily you go across the country or leave somewhere else, but you're able to stand on your own 2 feet. You're able to make a living and do that. You're able to be responsible and take care of a wife. You don't get to have sex till you get married. That's God's ways, right? I mean, that's the absolute that God says. So the bottom line is boys don't get to get married, you know? And boys don't get to have sex. And in our culture, we said, no, that's fine. We don't have that parameter. We've often talked on Thursday nights, well, why did God put the sex drive in a 12-year-old boy? You know, if just 12-year-old boys probably aren't ready to get married, huh? You know, I haven't seen too many of them anyway. Why did he do that? You know, and I would contend, you know, on one level, to drive them to grow up. You know, because if they have these absolutes within them that, but I don't get to play, I don't get to have sex until I get, and it's not all about sex. Marriage isn't all about sex, but it's a driving force. Anybody who says it isn't, a liar. You know, it's a driving force, and a driving force is a kid. And a kid, when he's got this driving force, well, what's it mean, Dad? Well, it means grow up. You know, it means become a man so that then you can go. You know, it's, I often use the thing because, I used to use the word, you know, Corvette, but it might be better to have a brand new Raptor in the garage, right? You know, so you've got this Raptor pickup. I don't know how many you know, but it's a really nice pickup, you know, sweet pickup. Okay. And you've got that in the garage and it's brand new, never been out, right? And says, you know what? When you turn 16 and you're responsible, you can go drive it. You know, when you show that responsibility, you can go drive it. But not before, you know, and that's the same thing. You know, the kids look at it and go, man, I can't wait to, what do I need to do that? Well, I need to be responsible. I need to get some gas money. I need to pay for my insurance. I need to learn how to drive. I need to do this. Is a kid willing to wait from the time he's 12 till he's 16 doing it? Yeah. You know, or is he going to go when mom and dad aren't home, sneak out and take thing in the back 40 and trash it? You know, that's what most people do. Most kids in our culture do. They take the pickup out and trash it. By the time they get to be 16 or 17, the thing's beat up because they didn't really know how to drive. They weren't responsible. They were irresponsible. And they get their things crashed, been crashed, stuck in the ditch, and sides are scraped up. And they go to, and now all of a sudden, oh, I got my new pickup that's not really so new anymore because I didn't take care of it the way it should be. And that falls way short of what sexuality is. But we abuse it. It's okay if a kid learned, man, when I reach this age of accountability, I can go do this. We need to teach our children that. We need to teach our sons that and our daughters that. The sexuality is meant for two adults coming together as adults getting married. And that doesn't mean 30. Right? So becoming a man necessarily, you know, that could mean 16. You know, that could mean 18. It could mean 20. So the issue that the point that I want to make is I think it's really important that we raise our kids that you don't get to go through this irresponsible age of adolescence. You know, you're a boy under the authority of your parents, under the authority of your father, right, in his home, until you become a man and act like a man. And that should happen early. It should be pushed to do. David was a man prior to 30 when he became king, obviously, right? I would contend he was a man when he fought Goliath. He wasn't a 12-year-old. You know, he was probably 18 or something. He'd already killed a lion and a bear. I don't know too many 12-year-olds going to grab a, you know, bear by the beard and kill it, beat it over the head with a club, you know, doing it. I mean, he was the real deal. He'd lived a hard life. I mean, you look at David's life, man, he'd fought, killed men, faced giants, you know, just rough, right? I mean, and I think it took a toll on him. At this point, David was probably 70. We know that fairly well. He became king at 30 in Hebron. He was there for 7 years, and then he was 33 years in Jerusalem. as king. So 40 years he reigned on it. And, you know, Moses talks about 70 being, you know, the life. That's what a man's lifespan is, doing it. I'm hoping for a little more, you know, changes in this. I'm thinking, man, come on. I'm not on the downhill slide yet, right? You know, I got a mountain goat to go kill, right? My kids did say, Dad, you better start putting in for it, because I think they didn't finish that sentence. It would have been, because we don't want to carry you up there to do it, you know, or have to carry you down to do it or something. But okay, because it's been a lifelong dream of mine to go spend that time and to have that image of God's glory in a funky, beautiful white mountain goat that the kids in the next generation can look at and go, wow, you know, that's cool. So anyway, here's David at the end of his life at 70. We don't know why or what was ailing, what was doing. Obviously, last chapter we read, he couldn't stay warm even, right? They read him, he was bedridden at this point. He just, you know, went through the whole tough deal. Adonijah came in, and one of his oldest sons probably left remaining at this point. Probably his fourth oldest son, but his oldest son left alive. Came in and tried to pull a coup, right? Tried to take over the kingdom. And, you know, David was merciful towards him. He was merciful towards him and made a statement that is really key to what happens next in this. And at the end of verse chapter 1 of 1 Kings, it says, verse 52, it says, and Solomon said, if he will be a worthy man, not one of his hairs will fall to the ground. But if wickedness is found in him, he will die. That's pretty key to understanding what happens. So Solomon sent, they brought him down from the altar, and he came and prostrated himself before King Solomon, and Solomon said, go to your house. That's a younger 16-year-old brother potentially telling his 30-year-old brother, you know, go to your room, you know, doing it. I think that there was some tough things to get over. Solomon was put in his place. You know, I don't know if David quite acknowledged it, but, you know, Solomon was different. We don't have any indication. I mean, David was raised in the mountains, right? I mean, David was raised herding sheep and killing bears and killing lions and then pretty quickly killing giants, literally, and then becoming a leader of Saul's army at a very young age, you know, in his 20s, you know, doing it, and was leading Saul's army, and then he spent, you know, 10 years or something running around, 8 years or whatever, running around the mountains, fleeing in this radical battle that Saul was after him, trying to kill him. I mean, you know, David had been after it in a sense, you know, toughened up and hardened by the world. For everything we know, Solomon is quite a different kid. He was raised in the palace, probably. So he looked a lot different than David did growing up. I'm not sure, you know, how David felt about him at 16, you know, what that looked like. But I think it's an important charge, because if we could take on this charge as men, not only for ourselves, as mothers, not only for ourselves, but towards our children, there's few things that we could hold as a charge towards our children in this happening. It says, I am going the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man. And keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, and his testimonies, according to what is written in the law of Moses, that you may succeed in all that you do and wherever you turn. That is not null and void, because we're in the New Testament day. That is still God's heart. The law and the commandments and the ordinances and the testimonies, those are God's heart that he's charged us with. You know, being obedient, we say, well, the Old Testament was about the law and following the law. New Testament, by grace, I don't have to do anything. All I got to do is say, Jesus, you know, ABC, Jesus, come into me, and we're good, right? And we stand solely under the grace of God. I think that there's a really good example here of standing under the grace of God. You know, it's interesting to watch when it was like, oh no, you know, where did his brother Adonijah, where did he run to? He ran to the altar and took hold of it, right? Like, I'm going to stand on grace, right? I'm going to stand on grace. The grace of God will cover me, right? The mercy of God will cover me. That's what he did. That's what all of us are here under the mercy of God. I felt like you guys were a little robbed today. You know, it was amazing to listen to the songs, knowing what, you know, God had laid in my heart and what I'd seen here. Because you think about the songs we sing, you know, your grace is enough, you know. And I mean, there's just a bunch of songs that we sang today that I was almost pulled the sheets and said, this is what it looks like. Are we under the grace of God? Yes. Only by the grace of God can we be right with him. But what does that look like? Does that look like being out from under authority and disobedient to God and thinking we can run and grab hold of the altar and be okay? That would be modern Christianity. It would say that. It would say it's not about my life. It's not about my actions. It's not about what I do. It's by what I say. And I fall back ultimately and say, oh, by the grace of God. Doesn't matter how, doesn't really matter how I act. Oh, I try to be good, right? I mean, I think that's the underlying motivation of contemporary Christianity is I'm just a trier, right? I'm a trier, right? I try. So you can't hold it against me because I try. I don't think, you know, if you say the Old Testament's law, but look at the New Testament. I challenge you to read the New Testament. And when Jesus tells us to do something, or Paul tells us to do something, what do? Say that's just a suggestion? Or if it's written, that's what we're supposed to do, that would be a commandment, right? If God inspired Paul or John or Peter or Jesus to say, do this and don't do that. Oh yeah, we don't have to worry about it. We're under grace. I mean, I know that's how you feel. It's just a suggestion. Or is there a matter of submission to him and obedience to his will? It's not by works that we're saved. It's by grace that we are saved. No doubt. But understanding true grace will cause our lives to look, to act in obedience. And to look like we're under that submission. Here you have some guys here that ran. In a minute here, Joab's going to do the same thing. He's going to run to the altar. Like you stand under the grace of God. The New Testament talks about it. Jesus spoke very clearly about this. He said, you know, in the end, many will come to me and say, hey, in your name, I cast out demons. In your name, I did miracles. In your name, we do this. And what will Jesus say? Depart from me. I never knew you. Workers of iniquity. I don't care that you claim to follow me. I don't care that you claim to follow me now. It's not the issue. You've been rebellious. And you don't just get to come a whole figuratively, go get a hold of the altar. We don't do that anymore because we don't have one of those, right? But intellectually, we do the same thing in our culture. We think we can just go run and say, but it's under the grace of God. It doesn't matter. I'm just in a belt. All right. God, Jesus already paid for it. No problem. We can just run to the altar. It will. Do we live a life that is obedient to God? Do we live a life that is in submission? Or are we rebellious? Adonijah, we'll see. We just read about what he'd do. You know, when he realized that he'd done a coup, and David all of a sudden said, nope, Solomon's king, and set him in place, and set Benaiah and all of his bodyguard to protect him and to set that up and put him on his throne and put him on his mule and said, he's king. And Adonijah went, uh-oh. And he ran. And where did he run? He ran to the altar, right? Took a hold of the altar and said, and it was told him, and he said, all right, I'm gonna let you live under grace, right? It's a mysticism of God. I'm going to give you grace. Should have been killed. You were just in utter rebellion to the king. Solomon said, nope. I'm going to exercise grace here, but if wickedness is found in him, he will die. Okay? So here we are. David charges Solomon. I would encourage you to underline that in your Bibles, verse 2 and 3. Teach that to your children. Repeat that to your children. Repeat that to yourself, that you teach your children. So that the Lord, so to keep all these things, to keep his statutes, his testimonies, what is written in the law of Moses, that you may succeed in all that you do and wherever you turn, so the Lord may carry out his promise, which he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons are careful of their way to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. Now, you all know, now here's the deal. David was always pretty gracious. I mean, throughout this study of David's life, we have this guy named Joab, right? It's his nephew. I don't know age. You know, we don't know how old Joab was, but he was his nephew, sister's son. That's how they always introduce him, right? Joab, the son of Zeruiah, you know, doing it. They always introduce him that way. So here he is. Now, you also know that Joab, the son of Zeruiah, what he did to me, what he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner and the son of Ner, and to Amasa, the son of Jether, whom he killed. He also said the blood of war and peace, and he put the blood of war on his belt about his waist and on the sandals of his feet. That's a big deal. I mean, Joab was guilty of murder. Okay? Now, had these guys, how do you, you know, it's the contemporary confusion that happens often of, you know, you can't kill, that's murder. God says not to murder, so I can't go to war, right? There's a distinction, and God makes it here. You know, if there's killing in war, and there's killing outside of war, on doing that. Joab was guilty of it. And he was a unbelievable, you know, strategist and political zealot. I mean, God did use him to protect David's kingdom, right? But on the other hand, I mean, he killed, these two men were both innocent. I mean, the first one, you know, Abner was the head of, he'd been made head when David took over, Saul's son fled, and they went, and Abner went with him, was one of his commanders. He became commander of that group of men under under Saul's son, Ishbosheth. And then David said, hey, come, let's talk. I'll grant you peace, right? You'll be all right. So he came and said, all right. Actually, it was a little different. Ishbosheth said, I want to come and give peace and give my allegiance to you because Saul's son's an angry little dude, kind of, you know. But so he did, and Joab deceived him and said, and David said, okay, I grant you peace. I grant you, you know, clemency, basically. You're free. You know, I'm not going to hold you for war crimes. You're good. Let's do this. And Abner says, okay, I'm going to go back and I'm going to tell all the guys, we're on your team, man. We're all together. Let's unite this kingdom. Let's quit fighting against each other. And Joab said, hey, good job. Let me shake your hand. And murdered him. And the other one was the same thing. Amasa, remember? Amasa was the one that after David came back from fleeing Absalom, and he came back in and he made Amasa the head of his army. Job had been in that place prior, and he made Amasa the head of his army. And Job goes, no, this isn't going to get so, hey, let me congratulate you, buddy. And he reached out his hand and took a sword and killed him, murdered him doing it. So Joab was a murderer, and Absalom himself, David's own son. What did David say? Be merciful, right? Be merciful. When you see my son Absalom, it's Absalom, you be merciful. What Joab said, I'm going to be ruthless, man. While he's hanging caught in an oak limb, we're going to kill him. Right? I mean, this guy's actions had been rebellious and disobedient. Right? His whole life. So act on your own wisdom and do not let his gray hair go down to Sheol in peace, but show kindness to the sons of Barzillah, to the Gileadite, and let them be among those who eat at your table, for they assisted me when I fled from Absalom, your brother. Remember? Those were the guys that brought him supplies when he crossed over the river, gone to the east, and Absalom was coming after him to attack him, and these guys supplied him. Otherwise, he and his army probably would have died out there in the desert. It ain't a pretty place on that side of the Jordan over there, man. It's not like there's green fields or something. I mean, it's ugly desert over there doing it, and this guy was a wealthy, really wealthy guy that brought him, you know, he's a proselyte, you might say, you know, he wasn't a Jew, but he came in and honored David, and they fed him, and David made him that promise. And behold, there is with you Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite of Beream. Now, it was he who cursed me with a violent curse on the day I went to Mahanaim. But he came down to me at Jordan. I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. Now, therefore, do not let him go unpunished. For you are a wise man, and you will know what you ought to do to him. And you will bring his gray hair down to Sheol with blood. Then David slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. And the days that David reigned over Israel were 40 years. 7 years he reigned in Hebron, 33 years he reigned in Jerusalem. And Solomon sat on the throne of David his father, and his kingdom was firmly established. I was thinking about it yesterday. Solomon was the wealthiest man in the world, right? We know that, and the wisest man in the world. This is probably the most powerful. God took this group of ragtag, rebellious, hard-nosed, hard-hearted, hard-headed people out there in the desert and made this, in a sense, the center of power in the world. I mean, he's the richest, wealthiest, and he brought peace. And he used this, you know, that didn't come easily. I mean, in Solomon's reign, there was peace. But that was hard fought by David and his father to get to that place. They fought hard to do what God had told them, to eradicate the Philistines, right? The Canaanites out of that country. It was good. I was blessed to hear that you've been looking that up, Norm, you know, and seeing who are these guys, you know. Because we talked about it a little bit, you know, when God called them, said, right from the beginning, said, go into this country, you know. When he told Joshua, and he brought him out of exile and said, kill them all. Right? And you're going, hey, that isn't very nice, you know. I mean, you kill them all? I mean, they can't all be bad, can they? And children and women and, you know, just, you're going to kill them all? God, that's not very nice. I mean, what are you doing? You got your spoiled little brats that you're doing? You know, what are you? Playing favoritism to these Israelites doing this? But, you know, Norm said he did a little bit of studying on it, which is very true. I mean, they were a wicked people. And God had been merciful to them for a long time. He'd pulled the Israelites out. That was Abraham there. He gave Abraham that country, right? He was to occupy that country, right? He was to live in that country, to take it over, to do it. In a sense, he gave the Canaanites that were living there, the Philistines, the Amorites, the Hittites, all the Ites guys, he gave them reprieve for 400 years. Right? When he took the Israelites out of there and put them in Egypt, right? 400 years they could have turned away, and yet they just maintained their corruptness and went more corrupt. And think of how many children were born and without ever having, you know, with being cursed, with not knowing the true and living God. You know? For a father who loves his children, for a father who doesn't, you know, I don't think it's just a random thing. It's a miracle of creation that God put in that children are born. And they were born into pagan families that worshiped Satan, basically. I mean, they were wicked. And God gave them that. And so when he said, Joshua, he said, enough's enough. Kill them all, man. Wipe them out. Did they? No. They left them stay there, right? They didn't. What happened? It's the same as our lives. I mean, it's a picture of our lives, why God gives us. What happens when we let sin remain? It corrupts. A little leaven corrupts the whole loaf. When we do not eradicate sin from our life as God calls us to, because he calls us to eradicate through the power of the Holy Spirit, to eradicate sin from our life through the blood of Jesus, the resurrection power that Jesus showed and gave us and made available to us is there to eradicate the Philistines, the Canaanites from our lives. And when we don't do it, there's a huge cost. There's a huge cost. Generationally, there's a huge cost. Generationally, there was a huge cost. Look at the wreck that happened continually. David finally had done that, right? David had finally eradicated, basically, had brought that whole region under authority, under the leadership, God's leadership, who God put in place there, the people were in under that authority. Pretty radical deal. And set this kingdom up for Solomon to take over and establish. And David realized there was, I don't know exactly how it looked, you know, I don't want to, you know, Solomon was, you know, again, he was the son of the palace. And David realized there's still some bad players here. There's some bad players here. And I think this is, in a sense, God's, not in a sense, this is God's action and God's will that what happens, happens here. That these guys had been rebellious, had been disobedient, had been, you know, had come against the authority that God had established. Now Adonijah, the son of Haggith, came to Bathsheba in verse 13. Adonijah, again, was David's older brother that had tried to pull the coup off, right? And David had given him mercy and said, if he is a worthy man, not one of his hairs shall fall to the ground, but if wickedness is found in him, he will die, right? So Adonijah came to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, and said, and she said, do you come in peace? Do you come peacefully? And he said, peacefully. Then he said, I have something to say to you. And she said, speak. So he said, you know that the kingdom was mine and that all Israel expected me to be king. However, the kingdom has turned about and become my brother's, for it was his from the Lord. That was a nice tagline. Pardon me. I think that's almost sarcastic. You know, that's a nice tagline. If it was his from the Lord, then why are you, then you're full on rebellious to God, right? If you really realize that and you really believe it, we say that often, right? To justify what we want, you know? You know, whether it's the, I feel a peace about this, or whether it's where, and again, I hope that those of you who heard a couple weeks ago when I talked about that, if you're troubled by that, that you'd, let's talk about it. Should we know a peace from God? Absolutely. Can we know a peace from God? Yes. I would contend we won't know that peace from God in the midst of rebellion. And I would also contend that when we don't take the time to know the voice of our shepherd, to know the voice of our God, and then we have a peace about something, it's pretty easily that we're deceived on what that looks like, okay? So, but, you know, here he is, he's using this tagline and saying to her and going, see, I know it was God's will, and that's what it was, but that really wasn't what his heart was. And now I am making one request of you, do not refuse me. And she said to him, speak. Then he said, please speak to Solomon the king, for he will not refuse you, that he may give me Abishag the Shunammite as a wife. Remember who she was? Abishai the Shunammite. David in his last years, remember, he was bedridden and couldn't keep warm. We talked about this, about where was his menopausal wife and that, when he needed her to stay warm, you know, doing it, you know. But they brought this beautiful, it says, young virgin girl, to be David's nurse during that time. Now, I said before that even though it doesn't say at the time, I mean, she, you know, who knows what? It says that to keep him warm, to nurse him, to be his nursemaid doing it. It says he didn't know her. He didn't have sex with her. He wasn't sexual with her. But she was the status somehow of a wife or a concubine doing that. It was beyond just, and we know that by Solomon's response here, partly, but that she had a status of, a higher status. She wasn't just the health home and services or whatever it is, you know, that came in to take care of him. I mean, I think that part of that was the intimacy. I mean, it says she curled up in his bosom and keep him warm, you know. Not a sexual thing doing it, but I don't know exactly what that looked like, but kept him warm on doing it. So she had this status. And this, the thing to remember as we read this and going back is, again, consider how did Absalom deal with, again, when he first came in, when Absalom first came in or to take over the kingdom from David and run him out, what did he do when he came back? What was the first thing he did when he came back in Jerusalem? David had fled, remember? He'd fled fast, leaving everything there, not much there. And he took his guys and some of his faithful guys, and they took off across the Kidron Dune. Absalom came in immediately. What did he do? He set up a tent on top of the palace and had sex with David's concubines. Right? And that why did he do that? Just because he was a pervert? Well, no. Not just, I don't know exactly what the thing is. I mean, the whole polygamy, why did David have concubines thing? We've talked about this. Because that was a big mess of his life. But why did that happen? He did that because that was, it was customary that if you take for your own the preceding king's concubine or the preceding king's rulers or his concubines or his wives, that is establishing and asserting authority that you are now the king in his place. Okay? That's why Absalom did that. And, you know, it says he went into a tent, you know, so it wasn't there. It was just obvious what he was doing in front of all the people in all Jerusalem. So they understood, I am now king. That's what Absalom was stating. I am now the authority. So when we consider that, so Bathsheba went to King Solomon to speak to him for Adonijah. And the king arose to meet her, bowed before her, and sat on his throne. Then he had a throne set for the king's mother, and she sat on his right. Super sweet. Respect, honoring of his mother, right? That's a pretty big deal. Had his throne set next to him. Then she said, I am making one small request of you. Do not refuse me. And the king said to her, ask my mother, for I will not refuse you. And she said, let Abishag the Shunammite be given to Adonijah, your brother, as a wife. And King Solomon answered and said to his mother, and why are you asking Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask for him also the kingdom, for he is my older brother, even for him, for Abathar the priest, and for Joab the son of Zeruiah. Those are the three leaders in the instigation of the coup and the rebellion, right? Abathar the priest and Joab. He says, why not just ask for the kingdom, Mom? Now, I don't exactly... You know, we don't quite know Bathsheba's heart. I don't know Bathsheba's heart. Obviously, you know, she was a woman of honor. I mean, you know, she was a woman that was worthy to be honored. Obviously had a lot of pull with David. You know, I wouldn't necessarily play favorite's wife. Again, what a mess. You know, I don't know how you can, I mean, our wife is supposed to be our favorite wife, period, absolutely. That's how God meant it, right? How do you do that when there's more than one? Right? I mean, it's kind of like children, you know? We are not to have favorites. One of the more destructive things you can do to your children is play favorites on doing it. I can't imagine that wouldn't be true of wives. I haven't seen a practice much with wives because wasn't raised in Utah and wasn't raised back then, you know, doing it. But it's got, in spite of how the TV might make it go, oh, you have lots of wives and they all get along and they're all best friends and everything's good on doing this. You got to think there's a level of favoritism that, how could you not? I mean, how could you not? But Bathsheba seemed to be very close to David and have a lot of pull and authority there on doing it. She went, I think she didn't understand. I think that's oftentimes what she's playing on. She's a woman as God so wonderfully is made not to diminish. I mean, it's always a wild thing. Why do you diminish a woman who has very powerful emotions that tend to control her? You know, what do we want? Women without emotions? Well, that would be nice, wouldn't it? You know, I mean, now obviously, just like, what do you want? A man who isn't strong? You know, well, that has its good and its bad side potential. Depends on what he's submissive to, right? Same thing as a woman. has the good and the bad side. Depends on what you submit it to, right? I mean, a powerful woman. What does every man want more than anything? A woman to be madly in love emotionally with him, right? How does that work if you don't have emotions? You know? I mean, we can be thankful that women are powerfully driven by their emotions. You want a woman to be powerfully driven by an unrelenting love for her children, right? Emotional love for her children even, right? To be bound to them, to want to give to them, to, you know, to, in a sense, be in love, as we say, with her children, because that's a powerful motivator, right? I mean, phileo, love, to be in love is a powerful motivator. That's the one that's blind. You know, it's good to have a little bit of, you know, blindness in a sense towards your children. I don't mean that in a way of overlooking their wrong, but I'm saying that I love you unconditionally. I love you and I can't help myself. I just love you so much, you know, doing it in spite of the fact you're being a little brat that I need to beat right now. I love you greatly doing it, you know. And we want that in a woman. It's not a negative, but that's why God put men and women to balance, you know, in a marriage. And that's why women are to be, it says, women are to be under the authority of their husbands for their protection. Because they're supposed to be powerfully emotional creatures. But that's potentially dangerous. There's nothing that blinds you more than your emotions. Proverbs says, guard your heart because it controls every other part of you. That's what he's talking about. You know, it can blind you doing it. So God, you know, a man, what do we want a man to be? Logical. Common sense, wisdom, reasonable, doing these things, right? It's amazing how we look at those attributes doing it, and a woman who has those, wow, that's really sweet. A guy who's emotional and romantic and loving, oh, well, that's sweet, you know. They're not bad. They're not bad things. They're very good under the context and under authority as God has called us to be under authority, okay? I don't know if it's, I mean, he was her half-son, right? I don't know if she felt like, oh, guy, he kind of got stiff. You know how mothers, it wasn't fair, you know. Adonijah, yeah, he is the oldest son. He expected that. Let Solomon, come on. I don't want him to think like you're a spoiled little brat here, you know, you're 16 year old. Let's go ahead and give him, you know, David's concubine. You know, big deal, right? What are you going to do with her? Oh, yeah, he ended up with 700 and 300 wives, you know. But I don't think it had anything to do with coveting at this point in Solomon's eye. It had to do with something very different. It had to do with that assertion of authority, making that statement. And that's why he responded the way he did, quite contrary to his mother. I think it's interesting that the writer of Kings here sets us up to say he was respectful to his mother. He bowed down to her when he came in, right? He brought her a throne and he honored her, right? I mean, he was respectful. So this wasn't a disrespectful little brat, right? Disagreeing with mom on this deal. And speaking disrespectfully towards her. David, or Solomon, was a wise man who was acting correctly. So he said, you know, for my older brother, even so, the Abiathar of the priest, and for Job, the son of Zeruiah, then King Solomon swore by the Lord, saying, may God do so to me and more so, if Adonijah has not spoken this word against his own life. Now therefore, as the Lord lives, who has established me and set me on the throne of David my father, and who has made me a house as he promised, surely Adonijah will be put to death today. So King Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he fell upon him so that he died. Remember, he's one of the ones that went to that altar. Grace, I'm under grace. You know, you have to have grace and mercy on me because I'm standing at this altar. You have to, which is kind of what we all hope is a bottom line we can say to God, right? Wait a minute, God. I tried. I said the prayer. I went to church. I was good. You have to. You have to have mercy on me, God. And Solomon was gracious, like God is gracious. He says, I'm going to give you a chance here. There's no wickedness found in you. You know, if you're obedient and submissive, good. What was this act? This act was one of still high treason, still in rebellion. Subtle, quiet, went to mom, you know, didn't get the swords out and fight like a man, you know, went to mom, get mom to backdoor the deal, try to do it, just be conniving. But his heart was wicked, right? His heart was wicked, and as a result, boom, God's wrath came down like it will on all wicked hearts. It was a song we sang today, you know, about wickedness having to do with the appropriation of God's grace. He died. Then Abiathar the priest said to the king, because he's going, my next? Abiathar the priest said it and said, go to Anath to your own field. Then to Abiathar the priest, the king said, go to Anath to your own field. I would contend that Abiathar the priest, Joab, and Adonijah were in on this together. Because he seems to address it all right here. Right? So Abiathar the priest, he said to him, go to Anath to your own field, for you deserve to die. But I will not put you to death at this time because you did carry the ark of the Lord God before my father David, and because you were afflicted in everything with which my father was afflicted. Your life was a life of faithfulness. I don't know why you're sideways right now. Again, this is to me the exhibition of God's grace. God knows hearts, man. And this guy, even though he'd gone sideways, God knew his heart on this deal. So Solomon dismissed Abiathar from being high priest to the Lord in order to fulfill the word of the Lord, which he had spoken concerning the house of Eli in Shiloh. He was the last. He was the last of the family of Eli. Remember, we studied that back a while, that, you know, God said enough. Your family, when Eli did not correct his sons, right? When his sons were bad, the head priest, and Eli, the head priest, did not correct him, he says, your family will be removed from the priesthood forever. Here's the fulfillment of that. This is the last one. Saul killed most of them. And Abiathar was the only guy that fled and got away. Now the news came to Joab. For Joab had followed Adonijah, although he had not followed Absalom. And Joab fled to the tent of the Lord, and he took hold of the horns of the altar. Here we go again. We're under grace, right? We're under grace. And it was told King Solomon that Joab had fled to the tent of the Lord. And behold, he is beside the altar. Then Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, saying, go fall upon him. So Benaiah came to the tent of the Lord and said to him, thus the king has said, come out. But he said, nope, for I will die here. And Benaiah brought the king word again, saying, thus spoke Joab, and thus he answered me. And the king said to him, do as he has spoken, and fall upon him and bury him. You may remove from me and from my father's house the blood which Joab shed without cause. And the Lord will return his blood on his own head, because he fell upon two men more righteous and better than he, and killed them with a sword. While my father David did not know it. And Abner the son of Ner, commander of the army of Israel, and Amasa the son of Jether, commander of the army of Judah. So shall their blood return to the head of Joab, and on the head of his descendants forever. But to David and his descendants and his house and his throne, may there be peace from the Lord forever. Then Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, went and fell upon him and put him to death. And he was buried at his own house in the wilderness. He was still honored. That was a pretty big deal. And the king appointed Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, over the army in his place. And the king appointed Zodak, the priest, in the place of Abiathar. Again, Joab ran, thinking, you know, you can't touch me. I'm under the grace, right? I'm under the grace of God. Who are you to judge me? You can't judge me. Well, bud, you've been rebellious and proven to continue to be rebellious, even though you reproved and corrected on it. You reproved, you continue to be rebellious. I think that Absalom was just a hardness, a fierceness, a brutality that was out of Job, but that was during war, right? Abner was the rebellious one heading up the coup on doing it, and it was an act of war, and it was during war, and it was during while they were fighting. He hadn't submitted to David in that, but it was during an act of war. But he'd killed these other men innocently, and there was no excuse. And he hadn't repented from it. You know, I think it was the whole deal. I mean, David even worsefully killed Uriah, right? He was a warrior. David killed Uriah, Bathsheba's husband. Had him killed. Doesn't matter. He told Joab to put him up front and then pull away. Get killed. He killed him in order to cover his own sin. What's the difference? David repented. David was brokenhearted. David was soft-hearted. he was broken and contrite over the fact that he murdered Uriah, committed adultery with his wife. You know, and David was repentant, and Joab never showed any repentance. That's the difference, is he was broken and contrite over it. That doesn't mean you continue to do it and then say, oh God, I'm sorry, I don't want to get in trouble. It means that he turned away from it, and he was broken and contrite about it. Now the king sent, and he called for Shimei, and said to him, oh, here's the other one David talked about. Remember the one that cursed him and kicked down, threw rocks at him and kicked up dust when David was fleeing from Absalom out of the city? Made a big deal about it. Said, you deserve this, you're cursed at him. Said bad things to him, okay? He sent for him and said to him, behold, build yourself a house in Jerusalem and live there, and do not go out from there to any place. Remember, the brook Kidron was what, right on the edge of Jerusalem, is what divided the Benjamites, would be the Israelites from the tribe of Judah. And Shimei lived, he was a Benjamite, he was of the family of Saul, and he had cursed him. I would contend that this guy was a political instigator, he was a pretty strong leader, he was a very wealthy man, it says. And he was an instigator. When Absalom came back, he was obviously in a position of leadership. Or when David came back from fleeing from Absalom. So Solomon was gracious. He said, build yourself a house in Jerusalem, kind of under house arrest. But here's what I'm going to do for you. Build yourself a house in Jerusalem, live there, and do not go out from there to any place. For it will happen on the day you go out and cross over the brook Kidron, you will know for certain that you shall surely die. Your blood shall be on your own head. Shimei then said to the king, your word is good. As my lord the king has said, so your servant will do. So Shimei lived in Jerusalem many days. All right. Solomon is gracious. He showed grace. He showed wisdom, right? He showed grace towards him. Like God chose us, right? What did Shimei do? How did he act in that? He said, yeah, this is good, man. I want the grace. I want your blood to cover me. I want to be forgiven. I want to go to heaven, right? I want to be saved. He said, okay, your word is good. But it came about at the end of 3 years. So after 3 years, well, I've been good enough, right? How many have done that number? I've been good for a long time. I deserve a little sin, you know? I've been really good, you know? We all sin, just if, you know, I deserve to let out or to be angry or to strike out or to lust or to do whatever I can do, right? At the end of 3 years, that two of the servants of Shimei ran away to Achish, the son of Maacah, king of Gath. And they told Shimei, saying, behold, your servants are in Gath. And then Shimei arose, saddled his donkey, and went to Gath, to Achish, to look for his servants. And Shimei went and brought his servants from Gath. And it was told Solomon that Shimei had gone from Jerusalem to Gath, and had returned. So the king sent and called for Shimei, and said to him, did I not make you swear by the Lord and solemnly warn you, saying, you will know for certain that on the day you depart and go anywhere, you shall surely die? And you said to me, the word which I have heard is good. You agreed and did this. Why then have you not kept the oath of the Lord, the commandment which I have laid on you? The king said to Shimei, you know all the evil which you acknowledge in your heart, which you did to my father David. Therefore, the Lord shall return your evil upon your own head. But King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David shall be established before the Lord forever. So the king commanded Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he went down and fell upon him so that he died. Thus the kingdom was established in the hands of Solomon. Again, I think that's an example of doing it. What do we make? Do we make an oath to God? Do we make a vow to God to say, I will serve you with all my heart, all my soul, all my mind, and all my strength? If we don't, I mean, that's really what the baseline is. It isn't that, well, I believe in the historical figure of Jesus. Oh yeah, you know, I believe in that. I believe the Bible's true. It's, no, I make an oath to serve you as my king. What was his heart? Why was his heart not forgivable? Because his heart stayed hard. He wanted the benefits of forgiveness. He wanted the benefits of grace. He wanted the benefits of the power of God, just like most of us do. Most of us, you know, it's even preached that way in our culture. Well, I know your life's all right, but don't you want your life to be better? Don't you want to have joy? Don't you want to have forgiveness? Don't you want to have peace? Don't you want to have a God who's there at your beck and call? Well, yeah, of course, man. I mean, Yahweh or a genie, I don't care which one you got, man. You know? I mean, I'll take the genie if that works, you know, doing it. I can rub the pot and life's good and it'll come back and do my beck and call. But, you know, that's what most people, in fact, we think that's a valid way to lure people in, right? Right? You want your life to be better? Most people, I contend, do not say the prayer based on understanding and a willingness to die and give up your life completely. They accept God as dessert, right? They accept God as an end. You know, we say, oh, you've got this little hole left in your life that only God can fill. This void in your heart that God can fill. This little void that God's going to fill? What is that? What is that? It's dying to ourselves is what God, not an addition to our life. It's in place of our life. We die. We give up our life to the service of our King. We don't just take His grace and say, oh, I want your benefits. I don't want you to be telling me what to do too often. I mean, I'll try to, you know, we'll try to be good. I'll try to be better. I'll try to act nice. But that's not what it's about. And that's what Shimei did. I want the benefits. I don't want to die. You're going to let me live in Jerusalem, build a house, my own house, the only way I want it, you know, take my wealth and do that. But his heart wasn't submissive. He said, it wasn't that I'm going to serve the King and I'm going to remember every day the grace of the King towards me. He didn't. He didn't went out doing it. He paid with his life. It's the same with us. We should remember every day and be thankful for the grace of God. And if we don't live in a state of gratitude towards the grace, the unmerited favor towards us that God has shown us, we don't understand His grace. We don't understand His grace. His grace and His mercy should be something that motivates us, that moves us, that determines us. Because it's everything. Without God's grace, we are nothing. In the beginning of Romans, it says that God's wrath came down, and judgment comes down on all men who refuse to acknowledge God as God and refuse to be thankful. Thankful for what? Thankful that God has made a way for us to have a relationship with Him. Killed His Son in my place. And if we forget that, we are in dire straits. And in trouble. If we don't know that, which I would contend most people don't really understand that. Most people don't really understand the grace of God. They just think grace of God is, I can say the prayer and I'm good now. I'm in heaven. I mean, we have a propensity. I mean, a whole thrust of evangelism is get people to say the prayer. We don't quite say that, but we do. Let's get some converts, man. Let's get converts. To get somebody to say the prayer without is to create a Shimei who says, yeah, great, I'll do that. I'll stay here, but doesn't have a broken and contrite heart. Doesn't recognize what he had done. Doesn't recognize the mercy of Solomon, of the family of David towards him. He didn't repent and broken realize how wrong he had been and how evil and wicked he had been. He just wanted the goodness and he wanted, I just want to get out of it. Just want to get out of trouble here and the benefits. Not the work. I think that's it's been a ride to watch the difference in the hearts of people in this life of David. And the thing that I would encourage you always to do, as I've said before, is David is my hero. And David is somebody who, since I was a little boy, has been my hero. My namesake. You know, my parents named me purposely after David in the Bible. I long to be a David. You know, I don't sit there and identify. I don't think I identify with David in doing it. I mean, he stands as a pillar of a heart after God. And we should all look at him that way. I mean, David, was he a man of the flesh like we all are? Yes. But man, I I hope that I will live my days out where it could be said of me that there was some semblance of a man after God's heart on doing it. I mean, David was. So I hope you guys will be encouraged to read Old Testament stories. You know, I would assume we will go back there. We'll probably go to the New Testament next week. I have an idea where we'll probably go. Continue to hear God's heart in that and spend some time in the New Testament. Because that's the happy book, right? You know, it's Old Testament, man. That's a lot of bad blood and bad stuff happens there. So thanks for hanging in there for this last period of time. And thanks for giving me the privilege of being able to spend that much time with the life of David. That's been a sweet, sweet thing. So, let's pray. God, one of the great things that we could redo in our hearts would be to understand that you are still the same God, yesterday, today, and forever. You're still the God of the Old Testament. When you command, when David speaks your heart and tells Solomon to keep your statutes and to teach his children to keep his statutes and his ordinances and his precepts and your law, that is just the same today. Obedience will look like being obedient. Now, John said the same thing, the brother of David, inspired by your spirit to speak your words, said the one, Jesus said, the one who has my commandments and keeps them, that's the one who loves me. And the one who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and I will disclose, I will reveal myself to him. Your heart hasn't changed about what's there. You gave your commandments for a reason, not just to be a taskmaster, not just because you wanted to be a bully, not because you wanted to be tyrannical, and not because you're selfish. You did it because you know what was best to draw your people to you. You know what the enemy could use to cripple us and wound us and trash us and keep us from having a relationship with you. You knew how sin separates us from you. And how allowing leaven to creep into our lives destroys the whole loaf. And so you set up what is right and what is true. And I thank you for that. I thank you for giving us your heart about sin and rebellion in the Old Testament. And God, please help us to not worship and change over in our view of you when we move the New Testament. And as we live our life. Cause us to not think we can at the last minute. So many people, it seemed like when I grew up in conservative evangelicalism, so many people were hoping that at the last minute they could go say the prayer. You know, or if you're Catholic, the last minute you can make sure the priest shows up and blesses you, says last rites over you and puts some holy water on you and everything will be good. Well, hope that, you know, I can live my life and I can do what I want and then, you know, time it just right so that I can still go to heaven too. Have my cake and eat it too. What a life in the pit of hell. What a lie. And the primary lie is that a life in obedience to you is not glory and happiness and peace and contentment in this earth now. In spite of the fight, in the midst of the mess. So God, please teach your people, teach your friends. Please bless them. Please bless them with the heart spurred to know you more in a real way. Thank you for the privilege of having your word and getting to know your word and spending time in your word, illuminated by your Holy Spirit and teaching your word. Thank you, Jesus, for the privilege of having a relationship with God as our Father, because you died instead of me, instead of us. Cause us to thrive, to glory, to laugh, to jump up and down, to smile in your grace, and because of your grace. Amen.